This is News from the Center, 1450 AM WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center. And always on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. Israeli Air Force attacks are happening over the Gaza Strip right now. Extensive is how Prime Minister Netanyahu described them. Netanyahu says Hamas has refused to release hostages and rejected all offers at ceasefire talks in Qatar. The militant group says the Israeli leader has overturned the ceasefire deal. A federal judge demanding written answers to his questions from Justice Department lawyers at a Washington hearing. This when he ordered a stop Saturday to the weekend deportation of what the administration calls dangerous Venezuelan criminal gang members. ABC's Rachel Scott.
The White House press secretary raising questions about whether the judge's orders carry weight because it was delivered from the bench and not put in writing. Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller questioned whether judges have the authority to rule over the president's policies at all.
Trump claims authority under a 1798 Alien Enemies Act. Wall Street major indexes closed higher after 4 weeks of losses. This is ABC News.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
The Bucks get rolled by the Thunder.
Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Bucks fell behind early and lost to one of the top teams in the NBA, the Thunder. The final score, 121-105. How did the Thunder control the game? Doc Rivers.
They were so much more physical. They definitely came in with intentions tonight and played that way. They played great tonight.
Men's college basketball, the Badgers drew the number 3 seed. They open the NCAA tournament this Thursday in Denver at the Ball Arena, home of the Denver Nuggets. They'll play the number 14 seed, Montana Grizzlies. Marquette is going to the dance again, headed to Cleveland to face New Mexico Friday night.
Excited to be here, happy to be here, and just, you know, excited to see our name called because it's not particularly like common for a score or player or a group of guys to go to the tournament for 4 years. We've actually like did the percentage research, and it's like the chance of going to the tournament 4 straight years is like 0.1%.
That's Marquette guard Stevie Mitchell with sports on Mike Clemens.
Earl Ingram.
Today we are seeing the largest number of humanitarian emergencies since after World War II. We should be expanding our life-saving aid programs, not shutting them down during this time of crisis. I don't care where they come from. They are human beings. We weren't even having this conversation before 7 weeks ago, before Donald Trump took office, before a monster took office.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. News from the Center, WRCE.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of a working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Let's start off with my Democratic friends who've been busting my shoes over my non-support of Chuck Schumer, the leadership of the Democratic Party, and really the party at this moment. They're rudderless, they're leaderless. In fact, you know, I don't even think they're talking to each other, to be honest, because they don't seem to have any plan whatsoever. And that came out, you know, with the 10 senators who voted for the continuing resolution. But, you know, hey, I know we're not going to give Donald Trump, what was the line? We're not going to give him tools or something. Trump doesn't think Zelensky's got cards. No, we don't want to give tools. You think Trump cares what the Democrats do? No. And this is the reason the Democrats' ratings are so bad. The most recent NBC poll had just 27% of voters saying they've got a positive view of the Democratic Party. Gee, shocking. 7% say they're very positive. And those must be the people who are emailing me, you know, busted my shoes. The reality is at that level, why show up? Now, here's the other part of this, and this is where I don't lose all faith. The Republican Party's current approval rating is only 36%. Not a whole lot better. Better, but not a whole lot better. Considering all of the craziness that Trump's doing, I guess, you know, it is what it is. But I see this as a moment of opportunity. Schumer's got to go. Democrats got to find a leader. And someone in that party has got to step forward and say, hey, we're going to lead this country with some ideas. And you got to have some ideas. Look, I don't necessarily want to shut the government down. But when you've got someone who's tearing it down, when you've got people who are literally burning it to the ground, shutting it down for a bit, putting up something of a fight, at least looking like you're fighting something. Because understand, Trump isn't 1990. They're not playing by the rules, by any rules. For instance, judge says, hey, can't use that alien thing. Can't use the Alien Enemies Act of 1798. Nope, can't use that. They don't care. Shipped them out of the country. Claimed they were gangbangers from Venezuela. And look, I'm sure there are one or two probably. Who knows? But due process, something we believe in this country, it is part of our Constitution. It's part of who we say we are. Are we just going to say no? And now you've got, you know, these quote unquote gangbangers. And I guess they sent them to El Salvador. And that the right wing president there was like, hey, look, we're going to send them all to some terrorism camp and we'll treat them real bad for you, Don. They also deported a kidney transplant specialist, a professor at Brown University Medical School. Yeah, that's exactly what we want to be doing. Even though had a valid visa and a court order saying, no, you can't send her. Did anyway. And this is where we're heading. You're heading down the road with someone who Trump doesn't care. They said, oh, there's going to be a showdown with the judicial branch. Already is. They're losing. Now, Democrats, you're fighting with somebody who's not going to, this isn't Marquess of Queensberry. This isn't Mother May I. Grow a spine. Grow a pair. Get in there and fight a little bit. Even if you lose, this is the important part. When you're dealing with a bully, you poke him in the chest. Start organizing. I've been saying, maybe you haven't been listening. Every member of Congress should be adopting someone across the aisle and going into their district and saying, hey, how about them eggs? Hey, is this the chaos you wanted? Destroying the Department of Education? Is this what you wanted? Ceding all of our power to corporate interests? Is this what you voted for? And get out there and do the hard work of talking to people, of educating, of activating, of engaging, of organizing. I've been saying this for a while. It's not new. And I know, I'm sure, you're just beating up on the Democrats. No, I hope the Democrats get better. I know the Republicans aren't. I know they want to destroy everything that we love about this country. They do. They tell you. They wrote it down. And still, there were people going, oh, I didn't think it was going to be this bad. I didn't think they were going to come for me. I didn't think they were going to go after Social Security. I didn't think they were. I didn't think. First key. So how about now maybe do think. Think about how we're going to save our republic. Because these people are hell-bent on destruction. They're hell-bent on, well, returning us to the good old days of the Gilded Age. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Gonna take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the reality is what we're seeing going on in D.C., especially with you're looking at Trump and Musk, is an all-out frontal assault on organized labor. And look, what's happening to the government employees right now, I do believe will trickle down. The fact that they are stealing collective bargaining rights away from TSA workers and they're not honoring contracts kind of makes you wonder, how far does this trickle down? I'm here to share some thoughts on what's going on in the country and the world of labor. I've asked Brent Booker to come talk with us. Brent's the general president of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America. You want to check out their website, liuna.org. Brent, thanks for taking time for us.
Of course, Rick. Good to be on. Thanks for having me.
So I look at what's going on, you know, again, you know, stealing collective bargaining rights away from the TSA workers who fought so hard to get them. And then all of the firings and all of the chaos, I've had people say, well, that's just them. Am I wrong to assume that that trickles down to you, your members, to other unions across the country?
Well, we should never normalize losing collective bargaining rights. And when it gets lost in a headline of 20 other things that happened today, we can quickly gloss over the fact that thousands of Americans lost collective bargaining rights. And that's a problem. You know, this is something that they fought for. We fought as a labor movement for it. The ability to join a union, the ability under the First Amendment to gather, to have freedom of speech, to talk about this. And then if a majority of them want to form a union, they do. They negotiate and sign a contract at the stroke of a pen to lose that. That's troubling. And that's something that we should all be concerned with. And unfortunately, you know, in this day and age and the reaction to some of the other things that have happened in the last several weeks, you know, if it doesn't have a direct impact on you, then you just gloss over it as another headline and that's somebody else's problem. And I think as a labor movement, we need to personalize these stories and have people not just say, I lost my job, because Americans lose their job in the public industry, they lose it in the private industry every single day. But we need to have the impact of that job loss as to how it affects day-to-day lives and normal day-to-day lives of everyday Americans, and then tell those stories in a personal way, not just that I can't afford my rent, although that's important, not just that I'm living paycheck to paycheck, that's important, but what's the impact of this loss have of this federal agency on my ability to safely fly in this country or any of the other agencies that have been, you know, that thousands of Americans have lost their jobs.
Yeah, and look, you know, we take for granted what was built under the banner of an injury to one being an injury to all. People fought, bled, and died for the eight-hour day, for maximum hour laws, for child labor laws. And it seems there are those out there right now who are cheerleading them going away and being, well, it's not me, what do I care? And right now, it's the federal employees who are being targeted. But again, you know, this stuff doesn't just stop. The ball keeps rolling downhill. And I think it all eventually comes for all of us. That's the sad reality.
Yeah, that's the fear, right? And at some point, you know, we're going to have to all stand up and be counted.
Yeah.
And we also have to not get lost in rhetoric. We can't get lost in what others' perceptions are. We got to stay in the truth, in the facts, in the reality, communicate those. And then when there are direct impacts or indirect impacts, we got to talk about it. And then eventually at some point, maybe we're going to have to do something.
Yeah. And look, I look at the newly confirmed Secretary of Labor, Lori Chavez de Remer. A lot of people are hopeful that she's going to be, well, maybe my guess is less bad than anyone else. But I'm curious, do you have any thoughts on the newly confirmed secretary?
I do. Look, when she was a member of Congress, we endorsed her as a Republican in Oregon. She stood up and got counted. She was one of the few Republicans who endorsed and co-sponsored the PRO Act. You know, when it was first introduced, she was a Davis-Bacon Republican. So as a member of Congress, she earned our endorsement. She stood up. She fought for working people. And when she was put forward as the nominee for Secretary of Labor, we cheered that. And, you know, given who, you know, her record stood for itself, right? And her record of standing up for working class people as a member of Congress is how she, you know, earned our endorsement. We throughout the process, encouraged senators that we thought that she was good. And I hope that as Secretary of Labor, that, you know, she acts and governs as Secretary of Labor as she did as a member of Congress. And that's why we endorsed her. And that's what I think she's going to be. I'm hopeful that she's going to stand up for the working class, just like what the president ran on and what she ran on as you know, when she was running for Congress.
Well, that's my hope as well. Look, I mean, she was the best choice of worst options, in my view. I hope she does get, you know, lead as her record in Congress would lead us to hope. But I watched that hearing, Brent. There was nothing in there that made me warm and fuzzy.
Yeah, I would like to sit here and argue with you and tell you that you're wrong. You know, I can't. I watched the hearings. There were some troubling answers there. I think what we got to do is look at her record versus her answers. Now she has a chance to prove who she is. Is she her record as a member of Congress or her answers in the hearing? And I'm hopeful and will encourage and persuade and do everything I can for the voices of 530,000 men and women of the Laborers International Union in North America, to encourage her to have the back of working people and to be a fair arbiter and carry out the vision of the platform of the President of the United States, who says he has working people at heart.
Let's talk about that for a second, because you've got members throughout North America. That means Canada as well. I'm curious how you guys are handling Donald Trump's chaotic game of now we're imposing tariffs. Now we aren't. Oh, wait. Yes, we are. Oh, maybe not. I'm wondering how you guys are how you're dealing with this.
Yeah, look, we have members in both the United States and Canada, as you said. And last week we have our Canadian director, Joe Mancinelli, and Central and Eastern Canada regional manager, vice president. And he and I put out a joint statement last week. I thought it was important for us to have this voice of Layuna introduced in this narrative of tariffs. Tariffs against enemies of our country, that might make sense. Tariffs to try to create domestic manufacturing, you know, that might make sense. But tariffs to harm our allies, tariffs to harm a sovereign nation that we certainly have members and we all carry, I got my membership cards here somewhere on my desk, you know, that bonds an American worker and a Canadian worker who are laborers. And what I wanted to portray in that statement was to, you know, forget about the chaos, forget about the noise. Let's not lose sight of what bonds us, the family of the laborers, the family of Layuna. And let's make sure that we don't treat Canada like we would an enemy of the state or an enemy of, you know, of this country. And there are, we've been using tariffs in this country for a long time. We've never used it with an ally like Canada. And that's troubling to the point where, you know, the Canadian director and myself felt it was important to communicate, because we're starting to get questions from our Canadian members of where do you stand? Where's your allegiance? Where's your alliance? Who, you know, what about us? And Canadians are very patriotic, just like Americans are. And talking to some of our Canadian members and talking to some of our Canadian leaders, you know, go down their streets in their neighborhoods, who every house has a Canadian flag out in front of their house now. That didn't happen 6 months ago. So I wanted to really, you know, drive home the fact that we are a union, that there is a border, but the thing that separates us from other people is that membership card in our organization. And it doesn't matter who the prime minister, who the premier, who the governor, who the president is, that belonging to this family is bigger than a tariff. But these tariffs are troubling if they're using to weaponize and create enemies that of friends that we've been for centuries.
Yeah, no, I mean, the reality is you use tariffs in a strategic way, and I'm not an anti-tariff person. I'm not going to say he's absolutely wrong for talking about tariffs. I just don't think you use it as a bullying tactic. If you're using it strategically, as you said, to reshore manufacturing, to promote some fairness, to hold cheaters like China to account, I'm 100% on board. But as a bullying tactic, yeah, I'm not. You lost me.
Tariffs against China, some South American low-wage countries. That's different than tariffs against our allies. That's different, as I'll use your words, as a bullying tactic. From our best, longest, and most proud ally, there's so many similarities between Canadians and Americans, and that's what I've learned in my multiple trips every year, going up and crossing that northern border and visiting with those families, with those members, and seeing that they're not China.
No.
They're not an enemy. They're not paying child labor. They're not paying low wage workers to bring products into this country. They're doing the opposite. They're a unionized country that, you know, uses union laborers to build their infrastructure, to maintain and support their energy that actually gets shipped across that border. We should be thanking them, not tariffing them.
And they definitely don't want to be our 51st state.
I've not met one Canadian that was supportive of that.
Although I got to be honest with you, I'm kind of like, you know, I wouldn't mind having Canada, Greenland, four extra senators on the Democratic side, strong union communities, strong militant union society wouldn't be bad. Might actually raise us up in a different way.
I won't argue with that one either, Rick.
No, I understand you were in Alaska recently. I wanted to get some of your thoughts on what you saw on the northern slope, as I guess there's work being done on a pipeline there that was approved during the Biden presidency. What did you see?
Yeah, it was literally an opportunity of a lifetime. I went up and visited. We had 700 members working on the Willow Pipeline. It's a ConocoPhillips pipeline that we've been working, advocating for years, permitting process. This was kind of a full circle moment for me to see, you know, our laborers testifying at permitting from the very beginning stages to the end stages, to my predecessor, Terry O'Sullivan, calling the White House every day saying how important this project was for our membership, for energy security, to then be able to go up there and see it myself. It was cold, spending a couple days on the North Slope and staying at, you know, one of those work camps, one of those man camps up there, and really ingratiating ourselves with our members to see how they live as they build this. And look, they're traveling up there working 4 to 6 weeks at a time in conditions that, man, our members are badasses. It was a warm front. When I was there, it was -5 with 30-mile-an-hour winds. And everybody was talking about how warm it was. And you know, their conditions where they're working on, you know, the week before is -30, -40. And their dedication to the craft, their dedication to the environment, to doing this safely, to doing this the right way. You know, the protocols that are in place from the state, from the federal government, from Conoco, from our contractors to make sure everybody was safe. To build this, and you know, you couldn't see anything as far as the eye could see, these pristine lands, as to how they took care of these lands as they're, you know, drilling, exporting, and then transporting the product to give us energy security. At the same time, like I said, we have 700 laborers just on that one project of Willow. So it was a full circle moment for me to see, you know, advocacy, permitting, President Biden approving the permit, to now mobilization and driving down an ice road with my fellow laborers to go thank them for the work they do and see and feel the conditions in which they work in. Like I said, man, they're badasses. And I'm in awe of the work that they do every day and really proud to be able to represent them and tell that story of what they're doing for this country and how safely that they work. So it was a great experience that I'll never forget. And the best part of that was taking off those gloves and shaking hands with our members out there doing that work and thanking them for it.
I know my buddy Gary, who's the head of Teamsters Local 959 out in Anchorage, he would say the same thing. Because they got members, I'm sure, working up there, driving on those ice roads. Because, you know, this is a driver of jobs and good union jobs, good high wage jobs. And you hit on something I wanted to focus on for a second, because I know a lot of my left friends are anti-pipeline, but these are people who it is their craft. They want to make sure they do the best quality job and they do care about the environment. They're not going to go just tearing things up. They're going to do the best job they can do. Right? I guess that's a question.
That was my biggest takeaway. I walked off the North Slope and it's snow packed, it's ice packed, all you see is white. I didn't see any oil spills. I didn't see carelessness as we were building the pipeline to transport, you know, this energy to our country, and the craftsmanship that they have and their dedication to it. These are Alaskans that are building that, from the owner reps to the contractor reps to the laborers on that. They're not out there to try to destroy this land. We are all and should be environmentalists. There's a way that you can do it safely. There's a way in which you can do it with skilled work. You want to make sure that you got the best welder on the job. You want to make sure that the most skilled, highly trained Teamster is driving that truck on that ice road. You don't want an unskilled Teamster. You don't want an unskilled truck driver. You want someone that's got experience, it's got training that we provide, that the Teamsters provide. Look, we have a joint training set. It's the only school in the country that I'm aware of where it's a joint training school where the Teamsters, operating engineers, laborers, and UA all participate in. They got 65 acres where they in the summertime, they build a pipeline on their yard so that when they get into those conditions, it's not the first time of seeing it, so that we've got skilled hands up there doing the work, and they care about it. And we as an organization care, and there's a right way and a wrong way to do things. And my experience walking away from there is there's no doubt that we're doing things the right way up there in a skilled, safe environment in which we are doing everything we can to protect the environment, but use this resource so that we're not importing this fuel from people who don't export it as cleanly and as safely and as environmentally soundly as we do.
And it makes us vulnerable. I mean, if we're not controlling our own supply, we're then desperate to the rest of the world. How come we don't hear enough of what you just said, though? Because, look, I know that you have this incredible training program all across the country. Building trades unions have these incredible apprenticeship programs. How come we don't hear enough of that?
We don't do a good enough job communicating it, Rick. And the buck stops here with me at my organization. That's something that, as you know, we're focused on. Trying to increase our communications, change who we're talking to, how we're talking to it. I brought a film crew up there with me, got permission from Conoco to shoot laborers doing that work so people can see that story. They can see the conditions where they're in so that we can put out videos, we can put out, you know, short pieces on social media so that we can do just what I just did and talk about it. And then, you know, and that's something that I think that the Democratic Party has to do is embrace this, not run away from it, you know, and say that, you know, this is a natural resource that when it's done the right way, when it's done with union labor, when it's done safely, when it's done with the highest safety protocols there are, we can safely extract energy from our country, use it ourselves. We insulate ourselves from, from energy from other countries. It makes all the sense in the world as we are still developing wind, solar, hydro, nuclear, and all these other things. You know, we need a baseload. We need this fuel. And if we don't extract it from our own land, I don't want it in a barge coming from Europe. I want to use our own resources and know that it's our members, American citizens, Canadian citizens, skilled workers who are extracting this in an environmentally safe way. And we just got to do a better job of telling the story.
And also, you know, creating really good family sustaining wage jobs with family friendly policies. And finally, I want to finish up with, you know, it's Women's History Month. I know you guys are extremely proud of the maternity leave policy you guys have. And as I was reading through it, and, you know, I talked to the bricklayers and other unions who also have policies like this. I'm going, you know, how bad is it in this country when it's our building trades that are leading the way forward on family-friendly policies?
Yeah, and look, if everybody acted like the building trades, our country would be a lot better off. I'm going to steal some lines from my dear friend Ed Smith, who used to run ULICO as a vice president here and who passed away recently. And he said, you know, if everybody ran things like the building trades, we'd be good. People would be paid a living wage. People would have health care. You wouldn't have to rely on the government for health care. People would have a pension so that when they retired at the end of their career, they didn't have to rely on the government for anything because they'd already earned that money from there. So if the country ran like the building trades, we'd be a lot better off. And now you throw in family, you know, Family Leave Act, maternity leave on top of safety protocols, on top of wages, of health care, of pension, of vacation, of annuities, labor management, training. If everybody had the same values that we had, we'd be a far better off country. And I firmly believe that. And that's our goal, is to try to organize, double our membership. And we can't double our membership if we don't have more women into our ranks. And this maternity policy is a way in which we're going to hopefully recruit more women in. We're certainly going to try to retain more women in so that laborer doesn't have to choose the health of herself or her child or her paycheck. So we wanted to give her the opportunity to take that 6 weeks before childbirth and pay her $800 a week so that she wasn't worried, wasn't putting herself or her baby in a high-risk situation. And then those 6 or 8 weeks after birth, same thing. Stay home, take care of your child, and then come back to the workforce And the benefit of a collective bargaining agreement, it doesn't say a man makes 100% and a female makes 78% like the rest of the country does. Our collective bargaining agreement says a journeyman laborer makes X. And there is no wage discrimination when you're working under a union agreement. And we're trying to use that to bring more women because that's how we're going to grow. I wish the rest of the country operated the way LIUNA did to ensure health and safety, to ensure a living wage, to ensure health care, to ensure a pension, to ensure that when women get pregnant on a job site, that they're going to be taken care of. And if and when we get to that, we're going to grow our union, we're going to grow our membership, and hopefully the whole country grows and does the same things and have the same values that we do.
There you go. LIUNA.org, the website, if you want to check out Brent Booker's union and the work that they do. Brent, always great talking to you, buddy. I look forward to seeing you again.
Sounds good. Thanks a lot, Rick. Good seeing you.
I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Sound good? Maybe a way forward. Maybe Democrats, you know, start thinking about policies. I want to hear your thoughts. rick@therickSmithShow.com. Right back.
This is News from the Center, WRCE. Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For tonight, mostly clear, a low near 37. Strong south winds. Partly sunny for your Tuesday, highs in the mid-60s. Slight chance of rain late Tuesday night, a low around 40. Rain and thunder for Wednesday, highs around 55. Rain becoming all snow Wednesday night.
Right now, it's 55.
The Todd Alba Show.
Many of the supporters of Trump voted on good faith and said, look, he says some crazy things, but you know what? He at least is telling me he's going to help my family and bring down the price on my heating bill. And that ain't what they're getting. What they're getting back is a political middle finger. And we're staring a recession straight in the face. And Donald Trump does not care. Because at the end of the day, this was one big grift.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I got a kick out of an email from a listener earlier who sent me this clip of Jordan Peterson. I'm sure you know who Jordan Peterson is. He goes on to say that Elon Musk knows everything. He's bloody brilliant, evidently, according to Jordan Peterson, because, you know, he's done all these things in business and, he's figured out how to use tax subsidies to enrich himself and all this stuff. And I agree. The guy's bright. I agree. Where I disagreed with Jordan Peterson is he said, well, there are people out there who are questioning him and they don't know anything. I don't think Elon is dumb. I think he knows exactly what he's doing, and it's not at the benefit of you or me or any working person. It's about capturing government. It's about destroying government. It's about neutering government. It's about doing what Grover Norquist said, which is making government so small you can drag it in the bathtub and drown it. I believe he is fully focused on that. What's interesting to me is how the right-wing echo chamber has jumped pretty much all on board, and here to share some thoughts on just how bad it's gotten, I've asked my good friend Craig Harrington to come share some thoughts. Craig is the research director over at Media Matters. MediaMatters.org is their website. Craig, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thank you for having me as always.
So I look at this, and I'm looking at Musk, and I'm looking at the Doge ferrets, you know, diving into every agency of our government, and just with a hatchet, just slashing and breaking and smashing whatever they can get a hold of, and not for efficiency, not for, you know, good governance, but for, I could only assume, their own purposes, which we don't know yet.
Yeah, and the way that the reporting has come out around, you know, this experience that the federal government has gone through over the past almost 2 months is no one really knows what the targets are or what the end game is. But the disruptions are very real. And, we're here ostensibly talking about like economic repercussions that we're seeing during this Trump administration. And one of the foremost things that we've seen is there are very real economic ramifications for some of the some of the early disruptions that we've seen from this administration. The reporting initially was about vital programs that were funded by the U.S., by USAID, for instance, or vital programs that were part of the defense or diplomatic or development infrastructure of the United States. But as these cuts have metastasized, and as they've gotten further and further into the government, we're seeing more and more the impact this is having on farmers in the Midwest and on teachers who are ostensibly government employees, and many of them are reliant on funds that come down from federal subsidies, grants, and other programs that support educators, that support police and fire departments at the local level. We're beginning to see real ramifications of what it means to disrupt and to cut off these arteries of the federal government. And we're starting to see in public polling as well that people who were largely in favor of this idea of like rooting out waste, fraud, and abuse, even when you include those kind of those loaded phrases in survey polling, the public has largely turned around. And previously, they were willing to at least entertain the Trump administration on the economy. They were willing to entertain the prospect of rooting out waste and fraud in the government and putting the government on a more, quote unquote, efficient grounding for the future. But the support for that has waned as people have seen the actual consequences and, right. And that people have witnessed like what it actually means to go in with a sledgehammer and operate on the federal government.
No, but the reality is, look, I'm one who wants to root out waste, fraud, and abuse if it's there. Problem is it's really not there as much as what we've been told. And I find it interesting, some of the stories that are coming out, to your point, of people who were all on board with, we need to go in there and rip things out. And then when it affects them, they go, well, wait a second, that wasn't supposed to be me. That wasn't supposed to be my job. Wasn't supposed to be the program that I benefit from. It wasn't supposed to be the funding that keeps this industry going. I think, and maybe you'll help me here, is this a good opportunity to start educating people about what government actually does?
There certainly is a way that you can demonstrate the contrasts. And I'm thinking of, there was a young woman, I think she's 24-year-old Forest Service worker in Northern Michigan. And she admitted that after voting for Joe Biden in 2020, her first ever vote for any candidate, she voted for Donald Trump in 2024 because like, to shake things up, I guess, and then immediately got fired as part of these cuts because as a new employee, she's a probationary employee. She has fewer rights. Easiest person in the civil service to target is someone who's in their probationary period. And probation in the political or in the professional sense doesn't mean the same as a probation in like a criminal sense. You could be a probationary employee if you were just recently promoted in addition to recently having been hired. And so here's this poor young lady who had what she thought was a dream federal service job in the Forest Service. And now she's unemployed, living in rural Michigan with no prospects. And she lives with the regret of her choice. But like all of us are living with the regret of those choices. The question is, like, what are you going to do about it? I was just listening to Greg Sargent's podcast for The New Republic just a few minutes ago. Okay, it comes out every morning. And he was talking about the same thing. Talking about the opportunity that is created by these disruptions to really educate the public about what the government does, what the government was doing, and what the government is no longer able to do. This is something that the media has really dropped the ball on, and that, you know, we at Media Matters, we want to have like the media actually provide people with good perspective on what's going on in the world around them. But some of this is just becoming unavoidable. And you can see it at town halls. You can see it at you can see it in public comments. You can see it in online forums, and you can see it in physical spaces where, yeah, like there are protests out there on roadsides every day all around the country. There are people who are showing up at their district offices for their members of Congress. There are people who are showing up at these town halls and absolutely lighting a fire because this is what is happening to the government. The dismantling of the government is not what Trump had campaigned on, and it's not how the media portrayed his campaign for reelection. There are things that are happening, which we'll get into, that he did campaign on and that the media simply misinformed the public about.
Yeah, but but Project 2025 was out there. I know they tried to distance themselves from it, but it seems like the checklist is working. Now, one of those programs that you're talking about that people I think are going to really have a rude awakening over are these massive Medicaid cuts that may come out of this continuing resolution, where you've got right-wing pundits who are actually out there calling to gut healthcare programs for the poor and cheerleading this. You know, the people who, you know, maybe the woman in rural Michigan who's going to need healthcare when she can't find a job. This is when I think these programs really, really hit home and is an opportunity for that education.
Yeah. And it's really about highlighting the contrasts, right? Like the Medicaid cuts in particular, the first stark number that came out, right? We saw them working through this budget outline that the Republicans passed through the House. And it calls for $880 billion of reductions to come from a certain committee. And that committee controls Medicaid. And you couldn't, it's mathematically impossible to even approach one third of those cuts without cutting Medicaid. And so the cuts that they're proposing, if you just assume they come from Medicaid, that is a 10% annual reduction in Medicaid's benefits over a 10-year period, because it gives about $880 billion in benefits annually. So to make an $880 billion cut over a decade is a gigantic effect that's going to show up in the American public. And when there are tens of millions of people who currently rely on Medicaid, that means that the decimation of that program, the literal decimation of the program, cutting it by 10%, that's going to affect millions of people. And those people vote and they show up and they write letters to their editor and they call their congressional offices and they post on social media. And that is where we're really starting to see this acceleration in the kind of earned media space, the outside media space of people who not only are currently pushing back against what the administration is doing and what is being sort of covered up and amplified and promoted by their media allies, but we're beginning to see more and more, and we will see more and more, that there's just basically an unlimited amount of room for that to grow, because harming the federal government, dismantling the federal government affects everyone. And a sort of point of pride, point of privilege here, I live in Washington, D.C. The budget that they're talking about in the House and the Senate right now, this continuing resolution, includes a $1 billion cut in what DC is allowed to spend in its own government services. Now, that may sound like that DC is getting money from the federal government and they're cutting that money, but that's not actually true. DC is raising the money from me and from my wife. It's our tax money, and Congress dictates how much we're allowed to spend. And so they're cutting our budget. And by cutting our budget in DC, that's going to affect whether or not our schools stay open, whether or not our daycare stay open. I'm going to have my children not able to attend class because someone from Arkansas's second congressional district demanded that my city cut its municipal budget. This is insane. But that's the world.
No, it is the world. And understand, this election, a lot of people that I've talked to, you know, much like you said, the woman from Michigan, they wanted to shake things up a little bit. They wanted cheaper eggs. They wanted cheaper gas. Inflation they were angry about. The guy who in his first term, you know, Trump in his first term, talked all about, you know, how the stock market was the barometer of how successful he was. The economy, you know, being at the top of the list. I don't hear anything from them. What I do hear is them kind of poo-pooing the idea of there being a recession where millions of people will be harmed by. And I go back to what we're being told on Fox News and all of the other Fox News wannabes that, well, it'll be, you know, a short transition. You know, we're going to need a little bit to get through this. They're kind of poo-pooing it off as not a big deal when it is a big freaking deal.
Yeah, and this is what I alluded to earlier. The things that we're talking about, the dismantling of the administrative state, as Steve Bannon, Leninist Steve Bannon, would describe it, that is Project 2025. And you can just read through that book and see point for point the destruction of the state that we are witnessing, the destruction of the federal government they're witnessing. That is from Project 2025. The other stuff, the tariff stuff, the disruptions, the interventions directly into the economy, the macroeconomic effects that Trump is having that are resulting in cratering consumer sentiment. There are some economists who believe the economy is already in recession, the disruptions to the stock market, the 10% correction on the NASDAQ and the S&P. These are things that if you were following the campaign closely, you would have known that Donald Trump was basically campaigning on this incredibly reactionary, invasive and disruptive tariff agenda that was guaranteed to increase inflation and damage the economy. But that's not how it was covered on the news. Essentially, on the news, the policies that he was running on, the macroeconomic policies, the tariff policies, were simply not talked about. We would have really deep conversations about price gouging proposals from Kamala Harris. And then Donald Trump proposing a 25% tariff on Chinese goods was just a single line in the story. Media Matters has over a year of analysis showing that the extremely inflationary policy agenda that Donald Trump was campaigning on was just not covered in the mainstream press. It wasn't on the broadcast news. It wasn't in the newspapers. And when people voted in November, well, not everyone votes on Election Day, of course, but when the votes were all counted in November, a significant chunk of the American public, the people who supported and voted for Donald Trump, had no idea that he was promising to destroy the economy if he was reelected. And so when they are now witnessing it happen, a lot of people are shocked. And surprisingly, even the finance people are shocked by it. The risk analysts at JP Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs, the people whose jobs it was to like warn traders about this agenda and the impacts that it would have, most of them just didn't believe that he would actually, that like Mr. Stock Market, the president who constantly bragged about the stock market record closings during his first term, they just didn't believe he would enact and implement an agenda that would disrupt the stock market and harm the economy because it would look bad. But this is what he campaigned on. He talked about it every single day, yeah, doing these things every single day.
No, I know, because Craig, we talked about it here.
We
talked about it here on the show all the time. Look, I am not an anti-tariff person. Just so you're on the right level. I think it's a tool like anything other. I think if you use it strategically as part of a broader plan, it can be helpful to ensure that you're able to keep, you know, steel and aluminum production and domestic production healthy. But as a bludgeon, as a bullying tool, I'm opposed to that. But we talked about it during the campaign, and I said, look, I hope he doesn't do anything worse than they did during the last term, because I think a lot of people who are in my world of thinking he's going to use tariffs didn't know that it was going to be this kind of, we're going to go after Canada, Mexico, the UK, we're going to tariffs everybody. I don't think anyone saw that, or am I missing that?
No, I think you're absolutely right. And so people who are from where we're from, right? You grew up in the industrial Great Lakes and Midwest. I grew up in the post-industrial Great Lakes and Midwest, because I'm a little bit younger than you, just a little bit though. People who are from where we are from, voters, particularly blue collar workers, particularly working class voters, when they hear tariff, they instantaneously think that means this person is fighting for me. And that's something like a targeted steel tariff to protect a domestic procurement or a domestic supply chain, or a targeted tariff on certain types of appliances to protect a single manufacturer. And while they might have some disruptive macroeconomic effects, it mostly washes out. And then you can demonstrate that you protected the Carrier air conditioners, or you protected Alcoa aluminum. But what people didn't think when they heard Trump talking about tariffs, largely because, again, the news did not cover it appropriately at all, what they didn't know is like, a 25% tariff on Chinese goods means that Lenovo laptop that cost $1,000 that you plan to buy now costs $1,250, and you might not be able to afford it. They didn't realize that that means that Canada, which is the source of a gigantic amount of the petroleum that is used in this country, that a 25% tariff on Canadian petroleum would directly raise fuel oil prices and gasoline prices. People didn't think like, oh, are avocados going to cost 50 cents more per unit when Donald Trump takes office? Where are we going to get strawberries? How much does a banana cost in the Trump economy? No one knew this. And voters didn't really think about it because it wasn't talked about on the news at all. It was just like, Trump is proposing tariffs. Yeah. Well, like, what does that mean? He's not talking about direct, specific targeted interventions. These are broad disruptions to the economy. I think it was 2 or 3 days ago, you had Lori Wallach on your program, and yeah, you talked about the tariffs in depth for a long time. Lori's brilliant. No one knows more about this stuff. She's forgotten more about this than you and I know. But she talked about at great length that the difference between this broad-based approach that's incredibly disruptive and is directly threatening to Canada, by the way, and he's very serious in threatening our two closest allies and partners, Canada and Mexico. The difference between how this is being done and how it was described by the not just the supportive right-wing media, but also how it was described by the mainstream press, is just completely discordant with what he was actually proposing and actually running on and what he is now actually doing.
Yeah. See, for me, Craig, this is where I want to finish up, because this is where I think Democrats and sane, rational people need to go into Republican areas especially. And I know you guys aren't partisan in all of this, but this is my view. You got to get out there and bypass the corporate-controlled right-wing media and create these moments where people are actually talking to each other. And get out there and hold town halls. Democrats need to get into these places and hold hearings to talk about the destruction that's being done and force the media to cover it, or we're not going to educate people.
Yeah, there's definitely a teachable moment here. This is a learning opportunity. And unfortunately, the United States doesn't have a Westminster parliamentary system. We can't like have a vote of no confidence and call a snap election. We're stuck with the government that we voted for until January of 2027. That's the earliest we can inaugurate a new government. And even then, we can't replace the president for 4 years. That's just how it works. But the public can become better informed about this. My fear is that we're going to become informed through the kind of cleansing fire of a very serious economic contraction that, you know, having lived through one of those early in my career, that's not a good solution, but it does have the effect of really focusing the public on, like, how did we get here? How did this break? Who broke this? Yep. And the thing is that it's an irreducible point. There's no way around it. A guy inherited a robust, sustainable, frankly booming economy. It's not just the U.S. was the best economy in the world in 2024. The United States was arguably the only good economy in the world in 2024. And it's not just that he inherited a great economy and is screwing up on the margins. He inherited a great economy and drove immediately into a wall and off a cliff. And that's unavoidable. And it will be unavoidable for the media to talk about that as well. That's what it was like in 2008 and 2009. Unfortunately, it was also a total disaster in the lived experience of 300 million Americans. And unfortunately, if that's where we're headed, there's no silver lining there.
And it's where we're headed, and they're destroying the safety net, the minor safety net we have that made the last collapse even manageable. So again, they're creating multiple crises on multiple fronts. But as I've been saying, you know, when the old labor frame of when your stomach gets empty, your head gets right. The only time we ever reunite in this country is around chaos and crisis. Maybe that's our future. But Craig, I appreciate the time, the thoughts, as always. Great stuff.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I'm Craig Harrington, research director there at Media Matters. Make sure you check out their website, mediamatters.org. Going to take a quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1890. That was the day that the Executive Council of the American Federation of Labor decided that the Carpenters Union should lead a national campaign for the 8-hour workday. The cry, 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what we will, had been on the lips of working people for more than 20 years. The fight for a fair workday had gained momentum in the mid-1880s. But in 1886, the Haymarket tragedy had taken its toll on the cause. When an unknown person threw a bomb at a workers' rally in Chicago, government officials used it as a pretext to clamp down hard against the labor movement. The decision by the American Federation of Labor to pick back up the call for the 8-hour day revitalized this workers' campaign. The choice of the carpenters to lead the way made sense. As skilled craftsmen, their labor would not be easily replaced. This gave them the leverage to stand up and demand an eight-hour workday. Their president, P.J. McGuire, was also a vocal supporter of reducing the long hours required of so many workers. In 1890, he said, "We are not a narrow, selfish trade organization entirely for ourselves. We have been and always will be ready to do our share in the general labor movement, whether it be to help the poorest or the highest paid worker." That May, 53,000 carpenters from 208 locals took part in 141 strikes. As a result, their actions saw gains in more than 30 cities as they won the 8-hour day. In many more, they won a 9-hour workday. The movement helped to strengthen the Carpenters Union and to continue the fight for better wages, hours, and conditions. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So it's going to be a bumpy ride with the economy. Again, you know, no one ran on, hey, we're going to tear it apart. We're going to make things so much worse. And as you know, Craig and I talked about during the break, you know, Trump left office with a recession and he's going to start another recession. And you know what letter begins recession? What 9 of the last 10 have been started under Republican administrations? So not surprised that we're heading face first into another one, because they love nothing more than taking, well, foreclosed properties from working people and lining their pockets. Get ready for the next round. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Tell me, how's the economy in your neck of the woods? A lot of people I'm talking about not doing very well. And before we wrap up today's program, I want to throw a shout out to Casey, her husband Steve, and the guys in the Beatles tribute band Rain, who on Sunday invited me and my wife and children to come see their performance and give us an opportunity to get out of the house. Casey, Steve's wife, reached out like a lot of viewers did. A lot of you reached out to me right after my wife's accident back in September, sending, you know, thoughts and good wishes and you know, good vibes and good juju and all of that, and have continually kept up with, hey, how are things going? Hey, if there's anything we can do. And, you know, Casey offered that, hey, if the band Rain, the tribute band Rain, comes into the neighborhood, by all means, we want you to come. And they invited us, and I took them up on it. And on Sunday, we made the trek, and my wife had an amazing time singing along and clapping her hands to the incredible Beatles music, because we were both fans. Look, you know, we took long road trips, and you know, one of the things that we did quite often was, you know, we'd be singing along to the Beatles song as we're taking road trips. So this gave us an opportunity to have our first real big outing, and she did really, really well. The sad reality is while we had an incredible time there, you know, we enjoyed the music, we enjoyed our company. In fact, a friend and his wife were in the audience. They came and said hello. The sad reality is that you know, when we got, by the time we got home, about an hour and a half after the show, my wife had forgotten where we were. She didn't know where we had gone. She didn't know what had happened. But she knew she had a good time. And I guess that's a start. And I want to thank Casey and Steve and the guys from Rain, for their, you know, their generosity, their good hopes, their compassion, all of that. And if Rain is in your neck of the woods, highly, highly suggested. One of the, just the top of the line Beatles performance. I loved every minute of it. If you're in Wheeling, West Virginia, or Wabash, Indiana, or Detroit, Michigan, or Van Wert, Ohio, or Joliet, Illinois, or Seattle, or Portland, or Reno, or Folsom, or Modesto, or LA, over the next several weeks, by all means, check out raintribute.com. Rain, just like the rain falling down, raintribute.com, and you can check and see if there are tickets available in your neck of the woods. And, you know, maybe if you're in El Paso on May 1st, you can go there, or in Tempe on April 30th. It was incredible. I had such a great time. Now, I'm not telling you you have to go, but, you know, we had a blast. And I hope you will take a look at it, and you'll have as much fun as my wife and I did. And again, Casey, Steve, thank you so much. I appreciate it. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to be an interesting week. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is News from the Center, 1450 AM WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center, and always on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Severson. Looks like the ceasefire in Gaza is over, at least temporarily, because Israel is ramping up attacks all over Gaza by its air force. Because, says Prime Minister Netanyahu, Hamas has refused to release hostages and rejected all offers at talks in Qatar. A federal judge demands written answers to his questions from Justice Department lawyers at a Washington hearing today. This over Judge James Boasberg ordering a stop Saturday to the weekend deportation of what the administration calls dangerous Venezuelan criminal gang members. They were flown to El Salvador. Of the judge's order, White House official Stephen Miller.
To put the lives in danger of the Homeland Security personnel on those aircraft.
ACLU lawyers suing over the Trump claims of authority under a 1798 Alien Enemies Act. A federal appeals court has denied a request from the Trump administration to temporarily stop a court order that required reinstatement of thousands of government employees. This is ABC News. Not stopping?
The U.S. airstrikes against the Iranian-backed Houthis in Yemen